So, Chris, did you know what you wanted to do when you were in high school?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to work on cell phones.
Cell phones?
Yeah. You know, pretty fancy little gadgets back then, even. I mean, they were kind of, it was kind of still the Nokia brick days a little bit earlier.
And, right.
But yeah, you know, there was some cool technology coming out, and I said I could do this for a living.
Did you take one apart?
Yeah, a couple actually. It was only later that I realized that, you know, that technology would move all onto silicon and stuff. So I really liked the circuit board side of things, though, and, you know, kind of chased that for a while. And what do you know? That's what I'm doing these days. So
so the exposure to the technology kind of led you into the field of engineering.
Definitely. What about you?
I wasn't sure. Coming out of high school, I thought I wanted to be a writer, but kind of saw the writing on the wall.
There it is.
And my father was an engineer. I had an interest. I had a couple of friends that were headed off to Purdue. I said, I guess I'll go to Purdue and be an engineer. So
solid.
It really wasn't until I was in school that I figured out that this was kind of cool, and I enjoyed the field.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it's important, you know, getting that. I'm sure you had earlier influence, obviously your dad, right? But
right. So I had that exposure. I remember my dad building a Heathkit stereo on the, you know, he had all the parts laid out in little muffin tins downstairs on the ping pong table. And so I was exposed to him doing that. When I was in high school, I decided that I wanted to get my ham radio license. So he and I headed off and took classes together and learned, both got our novice tickets at the same time.
Very nice.
So there was certainly that exposure to engineering. So I think that made it very easy to sort of, even though I wasn't sure that's what I wanted to do, when it came time to sort of head off in that direction, I was familiar with what engineers did.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And you know, for people that don't have that, oftentimes there's influence from school or mentors or a whole range of things. And actually, that's an entire field these days and a really big focus of education, right? So today we're going to talk about STEM education, STEM being the acronym Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And today we have Dave Young of Blue Stamp Engineering and Bill Porter. And Bill, what were you from again?
I work for the Navy, officially.
Okay, but you also do shows.
I do.
Well, why don't you tell us about it?
My main job is electrical engineer in unmanned systems, which is the Navy's fancy way of saying I build robots. My other day job, which is about 20 to 30% of my time with the Navy, so I do a lot of education outreach programs through the Navy and through the government. My main one, my flagship program, is called the Science Brothers, where we actually visit elementary schools in the local city area and some outlying districts. We'll put on a show for 30 minutes on stage, do chemical reactions. I have a big Tesla coil to bring out and play notes on a guitar. And it's just designed to get kids to see science as cool, that there's no reason to think people who like science are geeks, that it's a lot of fun, that it's something they should be interested in.
That's awesome. Dave, what about you? Tell us a little bit about your program.
So I operate Blue Stamp Engineering. It's a program where students come and build a project they're passionate about. This is like high school age students that have an interest in engineering. They know that they are motivated by something as basic as I like to take stuff apart and try and put it back together. And they come in and find a project that they can build under our supervision. 6 weeks, and the goal is to have them complete their project and then have full, I guess, industry standard documentation. So we'll have all the BOMs and all the schematics and source code, everything put online so then they can display their work. So it's a pretty fun program. It's intense, but it's fun.
That's great. And so STEM these days, I mean, you guys are two of the many that are doing this great work. And so, you know, Jeff, Bill, Dave, why the heck is this so important? I mean, that's the main question here, right? I mean, why are we here talking today? Why is STEM so important?
Yeah, I think for me, the most important thing, or what I feel like the work we do at Blue Stamp is so important for, is there's a lot of people that are creative and they're clever and they know how to do things, but I don't know what it is, but it seems like a lot of people don't feel like that should apply to their work. Their work should be just some drudgery that they go to and do so that they can then go home and create cool stuff, or they can go home and write, or they can go home and create music or whatever they want. And I think it's a shame. I think that it's important to show that not only is it good to spend your time doing this stuff, but you can get paid to do it. And people want you to create stuff, so find the right job and you'll be able to get paid to do what you love.
Hmm. Bill, what about you? Why do you think STEM is important?
Most of what Dave touched on, I think there's a problem with the youth either putting a stigma on anyone who says they like sciences or engineering, that, you know, they're socially inept, or they're someone who just doesn't like to have fun. And I want to change that. There's a lot of people out there who are in our lines of field that are very socially active and like to do this kind of stuff because it's fun. I go to classrooms and I'll have a group of kids that hang out in the back and don't ever raise their hands, and I'll do some demonstrations. They don't ever participate. But then as soon as the class is dismissed and they see the opportunity, they race up to me and ask more questions. And I go, why weren't you asking these questions in class? And they went, well, we didn't want to seem like we liked this too much in front of everybody else. So personally, I'm trying to get rid of that. I hate it when the kids tell me that, because it's awesome to do what we do. And I want to make sure kids see that as well.
Definitely.
Do you have any sense from talking with them as to why the stigma is applied to those who have an interest in science and engineering and math?
That's a good question. No, I've not asked them directly. I will say there are pretty definite lines along gender. A lot of the females, or the girl students, will tend to hide more in front of the boys, and we haven't figured that one out yet. And then as soon as all the boys leave, all the girls will run up and ask questions about what they saw.
Yeah, I see that too a lot as well. When we're recruiting for Blue Stamp, so the way we recruit is we go to high schools and we give short presentations about what engineering is and what it is for, what it's like to be an engineer and an entrepreneur. And we also talk about the Blue Stamp program. We go to all men's schools, we see a big response. We go to all female schools, we see a big response. When we go to co-ed schools, I see that same muted response, and it's a shame because you can see the fire in their eyes. You know that they're interested, and when they do ask questions, they're very intense. But I echo that. It's too bad that whatever force is at work is present. It's tough.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting from a drive story. You know, like who's interested in it and why. From the other side, I think there's a big drive from, you know, employers, the governmental operations, and we keep reading about all these stories of a shortage of engineers coming up. Personally, I don't mind it too much. That means probably more money for existing engineers, but there really is a lot of focus on it right now with that kind of stuff. So what kind of focus are you guys seeing from grants or even just companies participating? How do you guys see that being put into action?
Well, I work for the government, so my entire funding source for any of this is through grants.
Oh, right.
Where I remember I work for the Navy, and most of my activities either funded through local PAO, which is public affairs, my Navy base, where we actually try to go after some of the National Defense Education Program grants and some grants from ONR, which is the Office of Naval Research. And those are great opportunities. I actually got my first robotics team completely sponsored by ONR this coming year, and so I got all their fees paid off.
That's great.
Without having to do much work, which is excellent. But there's definitely it's the government's always in a state of flux, depending on who you ask, whether or not they're just saying they want to fund more STEM activities or they actually do fund more STEM activities. So it's a mixed bag from what I see from the government for the grants and things like that.
So is your story unique within the Navy, or are there a lot of people that are doing the same sort of engineering outreach?
A lot of the naval installations and a lot of the other arms of the defense usually have some sort of outreach program at their base, and they vary in size. My Navy base down here in Florida is actually a relatively small base, and because of that, we kind of have to fight tooth and nail for what little funds we can get from overhead and things like that. But there are bases kind of in the Virginia area or Newport area that are a lot larger and have almost facilities for STEM outreach kind of activities.
Wow.
That makes me a little envious.
Yeah.
When I visit them.
Right. So how many students are you reaching in a year?
It took 2 years for the Science Brothers program, just this one program, but we actually went to every elementary school in our county, plus some schools in some neighboring counties. And then we do several summer camps. I just finished a summer camp called the Florida State University Panama City Campus STEM Camp, where we actually take 1 week to teach teachers things, like I taught them to solder. And then the following 2 weeks, we help the teachers teach the students to do the same thing. So we actually try to expand our passion for engineering or STEM in general to the teachers so they can help pass it to the students as well. And through that, you know, we could be touching tons of people and not even know it.
Right. So you don't know how many students may be interested just by your presentation, even if they never show up at one of your camps.
Right. So we don't know how far this is. We're hoping this is going very far, but the government is always concerned about metrics, so we're always pressed to try to track this stuff, but a lot of this stuff's just not trackable. You can't tell how many kids you inspired to be engineers 10 years down the road.
Please fill out the survey after the presentation.
I will say, we just got a new hire at the Navy base, and she found out the Science Brothers is actually a recreation of an old program called Dr. Science that ran in the early 90s. And this new hire, a female, remembers seeing the program when she was in elementary school around here. And she says it's the reason why she went into mechanical engineering.
That's spectacular.
Great.
There's one. Counter for the stats.
Yeah, so there's guaranteed one in the stats that we can mark down now.
Yeah. Dave, what about you from the, you know, from the private public sector? Where are you guys seeing interest and is it actually resulting in funding?
Well, you know, we've only been running Blue Stamp. We're in our second year as well. So last year there were only 10 students in New York City. This year there's 8 in Houston and 20 in New York City. And we don't have grant funding or anything like that. We're all tuition-based. We do get some, for students that are in need-based situations, we do get some funding from various private donors. But it's usually to sponsor a student that is motivated. So, you know, it's tough for me to make a call on grants. We're just starting to look at that now since we've proven out the system and we feel confident that it's scalable and there's going to be money well spent if we were to get a grant to expand the program. I think we don't really get funding for the program. We get funding for the motivated students. You know, if we go to a potential funder and we say, we've got this student who's an all-star, they really want to do this, we can make it happen for them. All we need is to get some funding going so that they can come. That's a pretty compelling case to make to private donors, to private philanthropists.
Right. They see their money in action immediately, right?
Yeah. And the students, you know, 6 weeks later, the student's sending them a note saying, I did all this great stuff. You can see my website. I've got videos up. This is what I've been doing. Thank you so much. It's a pretty great system. Unfortunately, it's pretty tough to scale something like that. So we're trying to find grants and we're trying to find other funding sources that would make it so that we could scale faster or bring the cost down to a point that more people would be able to pay their own way. But it's a tough go, I think, to get into the funding resources if you don't have somebody that knows what they're doing with creating grants. Like, I'm an engineer and I do this program on the side. So the idea of writing a grant to me is so foreign. Or I don't know what I'm doing.
Right. That could be a whole different skill set.
It totally is. I was just reading an application for a new NSF grant and I have no idea what they're talking about. And we'll put something together. We'll get it together. But I'm going to have to call some friends or I have to do something because it's confusing.
Dave, I'm going to have to send you some links too because a program like that definitely would attract some interest from the government. And I can send you a few links for some grants that might help you out and might work out in the long run. You can never tell. Sometimes you get these grants where you barely write anything for it and they approve it. And sometimes you could put your heart and soul in the one and it comes back not approved. But it's definitely something you should pursue, and I can give you some links to some Navy grants that might be interested.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. That'd be great. But and we might want to include in the show notes because there could be other programs out there that are similar to Blue Stamp that could use that same thing. However, we've done one grant before. We tried 2 years in a row. It was like this entrepreneurship for social good grant, and it's kind of discouraging when you put all this time and effort in and you get nothing out, especially when I've got like this job that I have during the day that I can go and work at. And if I put more hours in, I get more income. at what point does it make sense for me to just go work more and then take all the money that I was going to spend, that I was going to make, and then put that into Blue Stamp instead of spending all my time writing this grant? You know, it's like there's this whole risk thing, and it's a mess.
So it seems like, you know, Dave, you said you had an engineering background. It seems like a big skill set of scientists is actually, you know, scientists are often chasing funding like that because working with NIH and stuff like that. I'm curious about, you know, how do you guys actually, in your education programs, how do you define scientist and engineer and mathematician and, I guess, technologist to finish out STEM? I mean, how do you actually define these things? And you know, do you delineate, or is it just kind of like everything's cool, you know, all this stuff is cool stuff?
I guess we don't categorize it at all. It's a very simple approach we take is, you know, find something that's fun, that you want to build, and let's make it. So whether that's something that may be more scientific, like one student built a Geiger counter from Mighty Ohm's kit and made that wirelessly logged to his computer and did some other stuff. You know, you can make an argument that that's engineering. You could also make an argument that that's science. What he does with it could be science. Like, he could use it. He's talking about adding a GPS module to it so that he could bike around town and graph the radiation of New York City. You're looking at something that could be used for science, even though it was an engineering endeavor. I'm not big on labels, but any of that stuff, I think, falls into it. And I'm not sure if anybody really cares, as long as you're creating or discovering or doing something. You're actually making something happen, I think, is what it just captures.
Bill, what about you? Do you guys cover, you know, scientist, engineer? I mean, I'm sure kids kind of lump it all together regardless. You know, I think you said you have elementary school audiences, right? So it's...
Yeah, one of our programs, and then we have our summer camps that are up in the middle and high school kids as well. No, we don't really draw any lines, or we don't try to push them in any one direction. We just try to expose them to many different fields as we can, just to see if anything sticks on its own. If any of these kids pick up one thing, or you know, I live right near the ocean here, so during the summer camp they actually wade out into the water and do biology/chemistry things, like testing the pH of the water and things like that. So we try not to delineate or push into any one direction. We just try to show them how cool the area of science or engineering could be, and see if anything sparks anything in them.
Bill, how much of the importance of what the students get, or how much of what the students get, is the personal attention, just someone being interested and someone caring, as opposed to the actual technical content?
Ooh, you're asking the tough questions. I would say that's also plays a big role. I mean, you get kids that come from overcrowded schools in Florida, and now they're in a class of 10 or 15, getting more hands-on time with engineers, including myself and people from my Navy base that come and help out. And I definitely see that it does make a difference. We've actually had some youth that were from troubled schools, you know, troubled youth who almost became a trouble problem with our camps. But as soon as we gave them a soldering iron and told them, you know, you could build this as well, they fell right in line, and they loved it, and they didn't have any problems at all.
Great.
So I definitely think that the smaller attention, the smaller class sizes, plays a big role as well.
Well, Dave was talking about the problems of scaling, and it seems to me that's one of the things in any type of education that you've got a problem is, you know, you can put stuff online, you can tell students to read texts, but a lot of times it's just having someone that cares, that talks to you about it, that has an interest. And that's tough to scale. It's tough to find people that are going to be willing to contribute time to these types of programs like you two guys have.
Yeah, and let me actually pose a question. I want to see how Dave answers it. If you had the choice between providing these programs for kids who are pretty obviously already interested in STEM and are obviously going to go into that field, or would you save the spot for someone who was unsure or didn't really think they wanted to do STEM, but you spent the time to show them how cool it was? Would you rather have that person in that chair in your room, or would you rather have the person that's already destined to be a STEM professional?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I want them both. Truth be told, I'd take
no,
both.
No, cop out. Come on.
I know. That's tough. I would think that I would take, for the Blue Stamp program, I think I would take the student that was most motivated to complete the project. And I would tend to think that the student that is destined for a career in STEM would be in it would be in a position to push through that time. So like right now we're in week 5 in Houston and week 4 in New York City. And it's that point in time where everybody's just hitting the wall. I mean, everybody's facing like 10 problems. Nothing's working. They got to get this project done, and they're not entirely sure how it's going to happen. You know, it's the case with any engineering design project, and it's tough. And so our number one admission requirement is motivation and the ability to push through those kinds of helpless feelings. Like you look at a problem and say, I have no idea how we're going to fix it, but I'm going to try this first. And we want the students that are going to not only try that first thing, but the fourth thing, and the 10th thing, and the 20th thing. And I worry that if a student's just casually interested, if they would be able to sit there and come back with that kind of direction or that kind of drive every day. So I think I'd take the one that was destined to be STEM, unless the one that was curious seemed truly motivated to complete their project. Like if they had a personal interest, like I want this light organ that's going to go in my dorm room when I go to college next year to work, then I think I might take that one. But that's a tough question.
And I liked your answer, especially for the kind of program you run, because I think looking at BlueStem Engineering, it's definitely a program suited for molding the future engineers, not so much creating them, but at least you know, showing them what the world's like, how much fun it could be, and kind of the proper etiquette for a professional engineer when you talk about they have to document and do a build of materials and things like that, that's actually giving them some exposure that they're not going to get in college, in most colleges, that's more to real world. But down here in Florida, we're more, a lot of the programs I do are more, you know, let's take the underprivileged and the youth that really don't have an idea what they're going to do and see if we can get them to be interested in STEM.
So ideally, the way we build this program is we take the students that have seen your presentation and now have a sparked interest and they're motivated. We like to take them and show them firsthand what it's like to be light. So we call it the, you know, after they've got their exposure, we're the immersion. So they get truly into the full experience. So they're going to feel the frustration. They're going to feel the burn. But they're also going to get that sense of accomplishment, and they're going to own their design. They're gonna be like, I know that design, and I know what every part in it does. So, yeah, I guess it depends on the student. It depends on the program. But we want students that are gonna finish.
So, Dave, I was watching a video today on YouTube. There was a young lady from New York who was showing off her project, and I just had time to watch the one video, but it was a some sort of voice changer, and she was identifying the parts on the board. And so, can you give me an idea of where they start with a project like that? How much of the actual design of the board do they do? How much of the soldering do they do? How much, you know, what is their involvement from beginning to end? And what do you want them to take away from it when they're all done?
That's a great question, and it's answered differently for every student. In the case of the voice changer, that's actually a kit that we buy from APOG Kits. It's like $20. It's no big deal. And we have students, every student that comes into the program, unless they really want to just do one main project, we have them do a starter project, which is like a kit. So they might build a voice changer. They might build like a mini POV from Adafruit or a Minty Boost from Adafruit or something like that. It takes just 1 to 3 days. And that's an opportunity for us to train them on the tools. We want to make sure that they're being safe. We want to make sure that they know how to solder. We want to make sure that they know how to read, like, this is a resistor, this is a capacitor. And it really gives them a grounding. On top of that, it gives them this, like, sense of accomplishment. Because when they go to do their main project, like I said, there's a lot of frustration and there's a lot of challenges involved. So what you saw in that video was just a starter project. So the student understands every part that's in the design and what it does. However, you know, they didn't design it and they didn't have to pick values or they didn't have to do any board design. That's all for the main project. Now, for the main project, we, like a month before the program starts, we get on the phone for 1 or 2 conference calls with the instructor, the students, and usually Robin or I will be on the phone, and we help them find a main project that they think is interesting. And so there's this, like, we have a project book of like 120 projects that students can kind of peruse with links and all kinds of things, and really just a bunch of open source projects. And then they find something or a few projects that they're interested in, and then we have a conference call to talk about, you know, what kind of experience do you have, what kind of stuff you want to get out of this, and how we try and gauge how advanced of a project each student can handle so that they'll be able to finish it. Because we have some projects that are insane, and then we have some projects that are pretty reasonable for, you know, like a freshman level high school student that's never seen code or circuits or anything like that. So each project has a different goal, has a different aspect to it, has different challenges. And depending on what project they pick, they'll walk away with some different skill. And so if you peruse the website of the YouTube channel, you'll see one student talking about code on the Arduino or code on an MSP430, and they'll be able to talk pretty intelligently about it.
Right.
But if you were to ask that student, you know, this is a FET, do you know what this does? They wouldn't have a clue.
Right.
Versus the student next to him who's been working with FET so that they could PWM some LEDs, they'd know everything about the FET, and they wouldn't know what a pound include would be. So each student will get a different education based on what they want to create. Every student, we like every student to walk out with first an understanding of what engineers do every day. Because I didn't know what an engineer did every day until I went on co-op.
Right.
In college.
Right.
You know, I actually think that's one of the biggest problems that we have is students are going in to college without the drive or without the understanding of what they're training for.
Absolutely.
But the second thing that we wanted to do is walk away with some understanding of the difference between what should work and what does work. So, you know, every student looks at a design or looks at something and say, yeah, that should work. I can have this done in a day. It does not take a day. You know, there's problems, there's shorts, there's bad parts, there's the design was originally wrong. There's a million problems that come up. And going from what should work, which usually happens on like week two, to what does work, usually happens on week five, I think that's a real eye-opener for students to understand that just because it works on paper doesn't mean it's going to work on the board. So, and by board, I mean PC board, I don't mean whiteboard. But,
right.
We want all of our students to walk out with that. In addition to, we want them to walk out with a prototype. So they keep their prototypes and they have their documentation on our website. We want them all to walk out with their prototypes and the documentation. But what they walk out with in terms of ability or understanding will vary widely from student to student.
Right. When you have students picking projects, do you have to consciously try to level out what's going on so you're not committing too much of your own time or your volunteers' time? It seems to me that if a student is too aggressive, you may find yourself spending hours and hours in the evenings trying to get them through their project.
Yeah, that's actually a real tough thing to do. So the application process helps us with that. In order to get in the Bootstamp program, we have a pretty significant application, and then we have student interviews, and then we have two references. We call on the phone, we speak to the teachers, and we get an idea of what they've done in the past and how motivated they may be or how experienced they may be or even how ambitious they may be, whether it's like good ambition or whether it's maybe overreaching ambition. But it's all guesswork and it's tough. And I should mention that, you know, the staff that we have in the program they're not volunteers. We pay the staff because we're competing with pretty great co-ops or pretty great jobs in order to get people to come in and work because we need high qualified people. But yeah, it's tough. And the instructors are on because really the instructors, so there's one instructor that leads a group of 10 students in addition to two TAs.
Mm-hmm.
And the instructor's on, and the instructor knows that they're kind of on the hook for this. So I'm not the one, or Robin's not the one that makes the call on whether or not a student can accept the project as theirs. It's the instructor that makes that final call. And I guess that's just because exactly what you're concerned with is you're going to get into a situation where a student kind of bites off more than they can chew. And how are you going to fix that? Because we, you know, our one of our big deliverables is having a student finish the project. If they don't finish the project, that's unfortunate.
That seems to me to be when you were talking about scaling earlier, just a real problem with scaling this type of process is you've got to continue to find good instructors who enjoy what they're doing, who enjoy teaching students, who enjoy sharing their knowledge, and who are willing to do so at whatever rate you're able to pay them.
Yeah, and it's really tough. And I think we pay our instructors pretty well. And I tell you, we pay them really well on a per hour basis. The problem that we have is, you know, the program runs for 6 weeks, and each day, each session is 4 hours a day. So I've got to try and find somebody that is willing to accept the job, even though it's got good hourly pay, that only runs for 6 weeks and 4 hours a day. So you're talking about a 6 week part-time job. And even the instructor, who has additional responsibilities before the program, even the instructor doesn't walk away with like a ton of cash. And somebody might be in the position of needing more money from their summer work because, you know, they're going back to grad school or they're doing something else or whatever their situation is. I totally understand. And it's really hard. I mean, we've got that problem on finding people. But, you know,
so the same problem that that many employers are having, right?
Same problem that many employers are having, except for I can't throw money at the problem.
That's right.
And the other problem is, you know, I hire somebody for 6 weeks. There's no guarantee they're coming back next year. So, an employer could really deal with this in a way where they hire somebody and then they try and keep them. And they kind of give them bonuses or retention or stock options. There's all kinds of stuff that they can do because it's a full-time job and it's a stable job. But with us, by the nature of the work, we're getting people that are on their way from one type of life. Like they just graduated undergraduate and they're going to go PhD program. We have two of our staff that are doing that. We've got another staff member who's just finishing their master's degree and they're going off into industry and they're wanting to take some time to do something really interesting like this. So by nature of what we're doing is we have people who are extremely highly qualified and they're motivated, but they're in this transient mode. So the probability of us being able to get them back year on year on year is less than what I'd like. It's tough.
So Bill, what kind of, Dave was talking about a lot of the educational side of things and, you know, the challenges of getting there. Do you go over similar things in your show about, you know, even though science is fun, it's hard, or is that kind of more of a, you know, leave it for later and just get to the inspirational side of things?
It depends on the program and who the audience is. When we do the Science Brothers program, which is, you know, right now geared for elementary kids, I don't know how you convey that to them with any realistic expectation for them to understand that.
Well, do you ever have an experiment go wrong on stage, maybe?
And not that the kids caught on to.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah, I think we gracefully, you know, walked around it and they didn't catch on to it.
Now look over here.
Don't worry, it's supposed to make that noise.
Yeah.
But we'll always open the floor up to questions at the end of one of our shows for elementary kids. And, you know, they ask some pretty tough questions and we'll tell them, you know, the reason we can do this is because we studied hard in school and put a lot of work into it. We'll definitely tell them that.
That's good.
In the middle to high school programs, you definitely have more of an avenue to tell the kids, you know, this is cool, but yes, it does require work and it's going to be math and that kind of thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. And so what is the response when you tell them? I mean, like, because, you know, it seems like, you know, I talked to lots of people about that and the, you know, oh, math, I'm no good at math. There's a very big, you know, you see that look come over younger people's
faces.
Yeah,
their eyes gloss over.
Yeah, it's just, oh, math, it's no fun, and I don't like it. And, yeah, you know, like, that seems like a very big stumbling block. And if I could go back and tell some of my classmates that I knew were interested in that kind of thing, it's, well, yeah, you gotta get through the math, but, I mean, I think about in practical engineering. Jeff, I'm sure you have this too. How often are you doing third-level differential equations? Triple integrals or something like that, right? I mean, like, it doesn't happen often these days.
I spent more than 20 years as an engineer and never once had to work an integral. Not once. Occasionally,
huh?
I would do something in Excel where I added up some numbers and I had the idea that I was adding under a curve and got a result, but
yeah.
I didn't have to solve an integral.
Yeah, and if you do, especially these days, I mean, if you do, it's in MATLAB or Mathematica or anything else, right? And, I mean, like, tools are there.
I was going to say, did anyone ever have the math teacher who would always scold the kids and say, what are you going to do, walk around with a calculator in your pocket?
Yeah, I had that.
Exactly what we do right now? Everyone's got a calculator on their phone in their pocket.
Actually, I have a supercomputer.
Yeah, that's
in my pocket.
A good point. I never thought about that. Boy, they've got, nobody can say that anymore because all the students would be like, yeah,
go
I've
back,
got one right
go
here.
Go back to school and be like, ha! But I mean, yeah, we got the point they were getting at. But I mean, I guess that kind of leads into just the education side of it. I mean, What I mean, you guys are on the inspirational side, the practical side, but I'm also interested in your take on the actual state of education. I mean, I'm sure you have, I'm sure you have, yeah, I know, right? I'm sure you have at least opinions on it, and, you know, they don't have to be long, drawn-out opinions, but, I mean, what about, let's even just start with the math side of things, or the rote memorization side of things. I mean, what's your take on that, and how do you play that off against what you're doing with the fun or the practical side?
Ooh, yeah, I think my thought on college education right now is it seems like they're all trying to train people to be in academia. And they do a great job of that. But for the people that want to do industry work, sometimes it kills it. Because like you said, you go into a math class and you're spending how many days on triple integrals time and time and time again. I always encourage my teachers when I was in college writing reviews or anything, and I firmly believe that every lecture should begin with, this is why this is important. Like, you can do this with this triple integral method. So you can integrate charge in a sphere with this triple integral. And I know that's not something that many people do, but at least you understand, like, oh, so this isn't just homework that I'm cranking out so that I can get the grade. This is something that I might use at some point in some time, or at least I'll get a conceptual understanding of why I should care.
And I think that's the important part, is that once you get done, it's not so much that you know how to work the triple integral, it's that you have a concept, you have an understanding, an intuitive understanding of what that means. When you see a triple integral, you know you're integrating over a volume, that properties can change as you work over that volume, that everything doesn't have to be homogeneous. These are all important things, so I'm not... In saying I never worked an integral in industry doesn't mean that I don't think it was important to learn those things, but that the ability to do the technique is much less important, I think, than the ability to have some insight as to what the thing means.
Yeah, and I always thought it was crazy that engineering students would laugh at essay questions. I thought every test should have, well, not every test, but I thought most tests should have an essay question. Like, describe to me what doing a triple integral means and how might you use it in real life. Like, if you can't explain that to me, then you probably didn't learn the concept, even if you can do a triple integral in your sleep.
I was going to say, that's how you find the people who are just regurgitating what they learned as almost in a calculator themselves, is when you throw a question at them like that and expect them to come up with their own answer. Then you'll catch the ones that, you know, weren't really getting it, but could do it.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's something that I think it'd be good for professors to understand. Most of these students aren't going to college to go into academia. Most of them are going in to get a job. And so their focus, or at least a significant piece of the focus, should be on that. And I had a lot of excellent professors that did that. And I truly appreciate the difference between somebody who is training you to think versus somebody who's training you to think then do.
I was listening to an interesting interview that the president of Olin College had done on Boston Public Radio a few days back, and he brought up the fact that in other fields, most of the professors, those teaching, are still working in the profession. That is, those who teach medicine are usually doctors that have an ongoing practice, or lawyers who have an ongoing practice. And engineering is sort of the oddball in that most of the people that are instructing engineering either have little or no industrial experience and are not currently involved in the profession in the day-to-day practice.
Actually, Jeff, there's a couple there's some things I want to talk to that about. I'm fresh out of the university. I graduated in 2009, and my biggest complaint with the university was I had professors that were doing the research at the university really didn't want to teach.
Right.
But being at the university to do research, you had to teach. So we had teachers that really didn't put any effort into exciting the students because they just wanted to teach, you know, hand out the grades and then go back to their research. I will say I did have a professor, though, that did really inspire me. His name was Norman Thagard. And if you know your NASA history at all, he's actually the first American cosmonaut. See, he went up on several shuttle missions for us, and he went up on several missions for the Russians as well.
Neat.
And he taught me electronics too, and he, so obviously he worked for academia. I mean, he wasn't a retired astronaut, It's I mean, you know, not many can say they were taught electronics by an astronaut.
Right.
But he was definitely one of the people who was passionate about teaching kids engineering, and definitely brought it back to the, you know, why are you learning this? It's because of this. So I think you're right with the fact that some of these professors are in industry and they lose touch. But then there's also the professors that are in research and don't really want to teach or do not make good teachers being in research.
So let me ask you guys this. You know, if you guys had to translate your programs to the college level right before people were going into right before people were supposed to go in industry, so either an inspirational type program, maybe at the entering school, or a program for, you know, hands-on training leaving school, what would change about your programs and why?
I'll let Dave go first because I'm actually envious of his program, so I think it's perfect for that kind of situation.
Well, our program really is preparation to go to college or to go to industry from high school. It's really made to show people how to do stuff. If I was to change it to give somebody education in order to go to industry, my first choice would be to tell them to get a job with a company that's good enough and knows to train their employees, because I learned so much on co-op and on my first job for years. I mean, years I was learning after college. So I would suggest they go do that. They go to some company who's going to train you and put in the extra time when you need to learn. Like, they're not just paying you when you get out of college in paychecks so that you can eat and you can live. They're also paying you in the training. They're giving you the opportunity to work on the things that you're given an opportunity to work on. So take advantage of that. Don't be afraid to stay until 6, 7, 8 p.m. at night, because that's you being paid when you're getting that experience. But if there was a student that was out of college and they love doing stuff and they wanted an engineering job, how would I change the program? I don't think I'd change my program at all. I'd say, all right, let's figure out what you want to do, and I'll put you in a room with people that know how to do it, and they're going to make you figure it out on your own, and if you really get stuck, they'll give you some guidance. I think you would just change what project they'd be capable of doing.
Okay.
So, Dave, do you do anything – I'm sort of back to the academics just a little bit. About 50% of those who start in an engineering program don't get done or don't finish. They don't graduate in engineering. So do you try to prepare these students that a lot of these engineering courses are going to be weed out courses, and that many that enter engineering just aren't going to get through it?
Well, I don't tell them that there's going to be a lot of people that don't get through it. I guess I prepare them by explaining to them that there will be hard pieces to getting to a cool job where you get to build stuff you love. So you're going to have to go through some classes that don't have anything to do with what you want to do. Like, you're going to have to get, you know, if you're a double E that wants to do only hardware, like I only wanted to do hardware. I didn't particularly like writing code. So I had to still take coding classes. I appreciate them now that I have to dabble in code every now and again, but I did not like that.
Right.
I try and impress upon them that this is why you're going through it. That you never know what skills you're going to need. And for every one class that is going to teach you something that doesn't matter, you're going to have other ones that do. And you just got to make it happen and got to show your diversity. And, you know, in the end, it's all teaching you how to think. But if you get through it, this is the kind of stuff people will pay you to do.
Right.
So, Bill, do you see that, do you have to teach that same kind of, I guess you're not teaching tenacity, but you're teaching the inspiration, right? You're giving the inspiration. So yeah. Would that change at all if it was, right before college, or is that too late at that point, or what?
I'd probably change or even try just to ask Dave if I could start a division of Blue Stamp down here, because what he does, I think, is exactly for that kind of purpose. If you talk about the pipeline, I sent you guys a link to a graphic that talks about the leaky pipeline for STEM.
Right.
Things
Blue Stamp. Run through the numbers real quick. This is actually, you could do this. I think you can do this by podcast or radio. So just go through the numbers.
Okay, I'll read them out. It's a infographic of talks about kids starting in or finishing up high school and going through college and eventually getting to STEM. And as you go on the pipeline, it's just losing water, and the water prevents the number of students. In ninth grade, there were 4 million students preparing to graduate. By 2005, you only had about 2.7 million actually graduate high school. with only 1.8 million with plans for college. When college came around, only 1.3 made it into college. Out of those, only 277,000 are majoring in STEM. And then finally, graduate by 2011, you only have 1,666 students graduating in STEM. And that's exactly what you're kind of talking about with these kids dropping out of the STEM, you know, STEM careers in college. And I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of it was they were just getting beaten down by the books and didn't have their hands-on activities to supplement the books to really understand, you know, why are we learning this? What's important? And I think that's where programs like Blue Stamp really could excel. I could almost see Blue Stamp just being a class at universities where it's like you just learned about controllers or why this happens, this, you know, or you're the math behind transistors. Now it's actually go apply it. And I think that's where a lot of the universities are lacking, is to have that hands-on kind of activities as well.
Yeah, I was talking to my alma mater recently, and they just instituted an intro class, and I was just intro to engineering, and that kind of thing is just having that you can make it. Here's why you should want to make it, and here's what you can do at the end, and actually going through some of the, you know, the activities and that kind of stuff at an intro level, just even in college, right? Because, you know, at least on the electronics side, I'm not sure about, you know, chemical engineering, mechanical engineering. I know a lot fewer kids are coming into college having, so a lot of them are just picking the engineering as a major without knowing much about it or without experiencing it much. Whereas maybe in the past, a lot of them were electronics hobbyists if they grew up with, like, you know, Apple IIs and that kind of thing. So having that context, like you said, is pretty crucial. So maybe you guys can smash your ideas together and make some kind of super STEM pipeline.
Yeah, even worse than that infographic suggests, you know, there's 114 people getting out of college with an engineering degree. I'd suggest you, I mean, you'd never be able to get numbers on this, but I'd suggest to you that there's another loss of water. And of those 114,000 students, how many of those students actually know how to do anything? So how to build something or how to create something or how to walk into a job and actually do stuff. I'd imagine that it'd be a much smaller percentage. So you'd have another funneling of the number of students that are capable of taking on design jobs or engineering jobs or something where you would build something.
Right. Yeah. And if you think about engineering as a, you know, it's obviously not. I mean, it's definitely not. And I've learned this over time as well. If you think of engineering as a design field only, then yeah, that narrows down a ton. Because a lot of people do go into other fields, you know, sales engineering, you know, sales support, technical support, that kind of stuff as well. And they're all very awesome engineering career fields that play to a lot of people's strengths. And but, you know, I think a lot of the thought process is, oh, well, to design engineering, that's like an even further funneling, like you said.
Let me ask this. Where should that fall on who do we... Who should be in charge of getting these kids to understand that? Should it be the companies that hire them should have mentoring programs to actually bring them up to that level? Or should it be the colleges that are building them up to be understood that they're, you know, the expected, this is what you're expecting when a company hires you?
Yeah, I might be coming off a little hard-nosed by saying this, but I think it's the kids' responsibility. I mean, you've got these students in college. They're over 18 years old. They're grown people. There's no reason that they can't search this stuff out on their own. They should be the one looking out for their own interests, and it shouldn't be like there's a class that they have to take, or it shouldn't be like they have to get a job with this company without a mentoring program. They should seek out stuff that they want to do and do it, whether or not it's them in their basement or in the engineering club or in the robotics club or the solar car club in college, or finding a job that has some training program, or finding a job where they'll actually get their hands dirty and create stuff. I don't think that asking colleges are asking employers to look out for the best interests of these employees or students is the appropriate way to go. I think we should put these students in charge of their own destiny and have them figure it out for themselves.
I think the only limiting factor to that is giving them the opportunity and the place to do it. And I think that's kind of the basis of your program, the Blue Stamp Engineering, is, you know, here's somewhere you can actually fulfill that. But when you have these kids in college that are trying to take 16-hour semester hours and staying up till 10 o'clock just getting through paperwork they have to do for homework, when would they do it?
No, that's true. It is becoming a struggle. But, you know, I'm looking at it sound kind of hard-nosed, but I don't think anybody goes to college and is overwhelmed with homework and tests. I think everybody has their time off, and whether it's drinking beer or hanging out with friends or being part of student government or doing something like that, I think it's reasonable to expect that people just spend time in the labs. I don't know of any school that would say you can't come into this electronics lab. You know, obviously they're not going to let you use the high powered wall transformers to do some crazy motor stuff by yourself, but you can use an oscilloscope and function generator by yourself. I think that asking the students to come up with it. And the other thing is they can prioritize things appropriately. So, you know, do I really need an A on this paper in my English class? I think I can go build something. Boy, I probably shouldn't say that stuff, but when you're looking for a job, that's when
you're going to get some angry teachers calling you.
But the reality is, if you're driven and you know what you want to do in life, why spend time really trying to get a 4.0 when a 3.6 will get you in the door for an interview? That interview is where you show them all this cool stuff you've built.
So I have a question about a point Dave got to there, and Bill, maybe you could tell us about how this plays into the program you run as well. You know, we've been seeing expansion of the definition of STEM, STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math, for those listeners who just joined us. But what about like the focus in, you know, university education, high school education on well-roundedness? I mean, is that a focus of your programs, or is that less of a, should that be something that is stepped down? Should it be engineers or only engineers? And, you know, like why are we doing that then in that case? I mean, I really don't have any opinion either way, but.
I know, Bill, what do you think?
I think it should be.
I was going to suggest you chime in on that one. I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Hot potato.
I think, I don't think it should be a requirement at university level, but I think it should be open to students to explore if they wanted to. And, you know, I just, you know, like I said, I'm a fresh product out of the universities. You know, I graduated in 2009, and I was kind of frustrated with all the classes they made me take and how many liberal arts credits I had to have, and how I had to take a class about the why people do things in movies a certain way, and I had zero interest in it, and it was just a waste of time. And I was just trying to mundanely get through the class to get my grade to satisfy the liberal arts credit and get back to what I wanted to do with engineering. But then again, there were classes I wanted to take, like meteorology, that I just had an interest in, that thankfully they let me take it. They kind of wondered why I was taking a class that wouldn't go towards my major at all, but they still let me take it.
I totally agree. And what's really frustrating, especially, Bill, you gave the perfect example. What makes a person well-rounded? So if I'm an engineer and I'm also into astrology or meteorology, I would make the argument that I'm still...
You said astrology, Dave.
It doesn't... even still with astrology. What makes you well-rounded, it doesn't have to be writing, art, movies, and engineering. It doesn't have to be that. It could be... Everything could be science-based, but you could have a love of studying dark matter and a love of doing electronics. And I make a pretty strong argument that you're still well-rounded because those fields are still so far apart. Even though they're in the science area, you're becoming more well-rounded. And the other thing that I think about that is the exact same thing that Bill said, is you're not going to make somebody well-rounded by sending them to a class that they hate. All you're going to do is make them less well-rounded. So you're just going to make them, instead of saying, yeah, you know, whatever film, I don't really care about it, you're going to say, I hate film. It is stupid. I had to take this class. It was awful. So the idea of forcing a student to be well-rounded, I think it's crazy, but I agree that they need to have the time to be able to do that or the room in their schedule. So just do whatever they want. Find out who they are.
So let me ask both of you, I'll ask Dave first. So if somebody else had this idea, hey, this sounds like a great idea, how did they go about getting something like this started? I mean, what did you do? You woke up one morning and said, hey, I want to start this blue stamp program. And where did you start? I mean, what did you do first? Who did you call? How did you organize it?
You know, that's interesting. I'm giving a quick talk with my Houston students tomorrow on exactly that point. It started with Robin and I and a couple other guys getting together, and we were talking. We just kicked around ideas for fun companies to start. It was kind of like just time to hang out either on the phone or in person or whatever and kick around ideas, and nothing really happened. And then one time Robin and I were at a bus stop talking about cool stuff we could do with, I guess, our lives. we came up with this idea to do only project-based, high-intensity, advanced engineering, where we focused on only stuff that would be fun. Because after all, this is a summer program. I mean, you can't, our kids are not going to enjoy going to a lecture hall all summer long. So we wanted to make it fun, but still super challenging. And the fun would come from the fact that the interest was already there. And I guess that's where it started. And we fell on our face a few times. We tried to start it in the small town I was living in at the time, in New York, and that didn't go anywhere. I don't think there was the population to really support a new program.
So how many did you have anybody enrolled? Was it a complete flop? Did you have a few students?
I had a couple people email me with interest, and I even went and spoke with a parent and a student. And, you know, since we didn't have any funding or anything, the cost was a real problem. And actually, that continues to be a real problem, I think, because at least in the cities that we go to, the public school system artificially changes people's expectations on what education costs. So when we come in with a program that's expensive, not only is it expensive because it's, you know, high quality, 3-to-1 students teacher ratio, all this great industry equipment, but you put that on top of like a school program where a kid might pay $50 to be a part of FIRST. And it makes it tough to get people to see that the value is there. We just don't have anybody bringing the price down for us. It's all tuition based.
Right. And do you mind ballparking what the cost is for this?
Well, for the 6-week program this year, we were at $3,500. So that's a lot.
Right.
Now, it's a lot. If you break it down to cost per student hours, it's on par with other summer programs that have, you know, a higher student to teacher ratio and not as much cool stuff. And, you know, I can make arguments for it being a really great thing to do at that price. And then in Houston, we had some people chime in and give a $900 scholarship to every student. So that brought the price
down. Oh, great.
It was like, we want you to get this program going. Here's a private donation to get your first class off the ground. So
beautiful.
We designed this program without any consideration of cost. And we focused on making it exactly as awesome as we could. That was what we wanted. And we kind of figured out cost after. So that's tough. And that's, I think, what really made us fall on our face in Ithaca. Because there was such a big disconnect between their excellent school system and the price point of Blue Stamp. So we went to New York City, and the way we recruit is we just call schools, call teachers, we call college counselors, and we say, hey, we've got this program. We'd like to come in and speak about it. We also talk about engineering and entrepreneurship. There's no obligation. It's just 20 minutes of a class time. And so we just tour high schools. And that's really fun because we get to see the high school's body. We can talk to them. And it's a pretty good time. And so we do that once a month for a few months to kind of drum up interest and get the applications out and they come back. Mm-hmm. And that first year, boy, it was tenacious. We weren't sure if we were going to get any application. You just don't know. You know, it's very similar designing something in electronics. Is this going to work? Boy, I don't know. Let's put it together and try it.
Right.
So that's how it got started. Is we had students that signed up, and we were able to find some staff who was going to work, and we went forward, and I think it was even better than what we planned. I think the students walked away with some really valuable experience that I don't think they would otherwise get.
Right, and were your graduates of that first program good promoters of the program for the second year students?
Yeah, we actually had them come to our presentations. Many of them came to our presentations to talk about it and their experiences and all the cool stuff. We gave them sweatshirts so they can wear them all around school. They were pretty good.
Terrific.
Yeah, well, a few of them actually came back for the second year. They were so interested and they wanted to keep going and keep learning. So we hope that. You know, I always tell parents, like, give me 6 weeks with a student and they'll get an idea of what's going on. Give me 12 and they'll really have a strong handle on stuff. Give me 18. You know, if I get all 3 summers of a high school student's life, that's a lot of time to teach them how to do some really awesome stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What about you, Bill? How did you get started in the program, and how did you make it go the first year you were involved?
I was actually, I guess, in a sense, discovered.
Right.
When I took the job at the Navy base, after a couple of months, I was doing little things on my own, and I went to a Girl Scouts jamboree, I think it was, and I actually, and you know, someone asked me if I wanted to volunteer and run a couple little Lego robots around, and I took an old costume I built that was a lab coat with LEDs in it, and went there, and the girls absolutely loved it. They loved my coat, and they loved the robots we had around.
Right.
And apparently, word got around my Navy base about this guy who had a lab coat with LEDs in it, bedazzling the kids at this jamboree. That someone at work approached me and said, you know, we used to have a big STEM program here at this Navy base. Would you be interested in helping us start it again? I said, absolutely.
Oh, neat.
And from then on there, we have a STEM program again. We have the Science Brothers. We have C-Perch, which is another government sort of program where kids build an ROV in 2 or 3 days out of PVC pipes. We have all sorts of programs that have spun out now. And I'm actually, even though I'm an engineer, I've kind of already bitten the bullet and taken the blue pill, and I'm dabbling in management a bit and actually kind of taking charge of the outreach program and doing the logistics and the management and the budget of it. And it's, I'm not super against it, but it does take away from the engineering.
Now, I get the sense that your program reached out a little broader area, that Dave's Blue Stamp was sort of focused more on electromechanical hardware, but that you sort of were work expanding beyond that.
Well, we have several programs that we run at locally out of our Navy base, and the Navy itself and the DoD has several more national-level programs that we're able to pull from. C-Perch is one of those programs. You can go to cperch.org, and there's actually instructions to build an ROV PVC pipe that you can buy at Home Depot. You can actually buy a kit for $147. If you're interested in bringing this, if you're interested in actually starting a C-Perch program where you live, they actually will help you write grants to apply for money, to get funding, to get kits and tools to be able to start a C-Perch program. So there's many things in the government you can leverage, and we leverage a lot of different programs down here in Panama City, Florida, with all sorts of different audiences. I just got done teaching a C-Perch class to high school sea cadets, which is like an ROTC for the Navy. Mm-hmm. So there's several audiences that we go after using various different programs. So it's kind of hard to fit the thing I do in any one category.
I think the key thing is there that you've got some inspiration for the kids. They've got them inspired to move forward and look into STEM careers.
Right. You know, that's what we're going for. We want them to like STEM and want to go in STEM on their own. We don't want to be pushy. We don't want to try to tell them they should do this. We want to say, look how cool this is. Are you interested in it?
So there's one last question for you guys. We're starting to run down on time here. Do you guys have a vision of where STEM will be in 5 years, 10 years? Do you have any idea about that kind of stuff, or is it more of a haze in the future?
Ooh.
Dave, you want to take that one?
I would guess the price of being able to get into STEM stuff, especially electronics, but also mechanics, and you know, software is always super cheap. As those prices come down, you know, I buy a scope from, is it Regal, for $320 or $350, and it works great. For $350, you know, you can continue to see these prices go down the same way computers went down in price 10 years ago or 15 years ago, 20 years ago now, I guess. But I think as the hardware costs and the startup costs and all those things continue to fall down, you're going to see more and more people just being like, oh, a logic analyzer, whatever, I'll just buy one. And the more equipment and the more stuff they use makes it more fun. You can see more. I think it's just going to be more and more people getting back into tinkering around without having to blink an eye at any of the cost or any of the startup stuff. So I think it'll get more and more fragmented and people doing it individually instead of the classic, like, this is science class, we're going to talk about this. This is computer class, we're going to talk about that.
Okay. Bill?
I honestly don't know. I see two major opposing forces that I can see that would really affect which way STEM education can go. The first one, as the good force, I'll call it, is the fact that, you know, there's things like Khan Academy, and this whole idea of learning from the internet is catching on, and there's educational resources online, and people are questioning, should we teach online? And I think that's definitely going to help. That's going to help a lot more with the unofficial education avenues. So we're going to see more awesome programs like Blue Stamp, and we can even see versions of Blue Stamp that are more online-based that anyone can take part of. That'll definitely help expose kids to this kind of stuff a lot sooner than we were. But then again, I look at our society and see how consumer-centric it is and how everyone's just accepting the technology that they have in their pocket. And it kind of saddens my heart that people aren't asking the question, how does this work anymore? They just accept the fact that they can pull out a device and FaceTime talk with someone across the world and don't really realize how cool it is anymore and how that's working. So I don't know which way it's going to go. If people are going to be more interested in STEM stuff, or people are just going to be more, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for is, more patient with what they have and not ask why anymore.
That's a really great point. Like, people are content to consider an iPhone magic.
Right, and they're so content with it, they don't have that wonder how it works anymore.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Well, I think it's good that we have both of you guys out there working to really drive that curiosity and drive that interest in the programs in order to get more people working on it in the future. I mean, we hear a lot about the pipeline and all that stuff does matter for future employment, but more so is just that general intrigue with how the world works. And I think you guys are doing a really great job with your programs and with inspiring people. So keep up the good work. So the last thing, where can people find more information about your programs? Just so get it on air as well as on the show notes.
You can go bluestampengineering.com for Blue Stamp, or you can find us on Twitter at BlueStampEng, or we have a Facebook page that I don't know how to find that, but we have one.
I'm sure it's all on the main website, right?
Yeah.
My main program, which is the Science Brothers, you can go to sciencebrothers.org. We have a Facebook page as well. I think it's / Science Brothers probably. But
yeah,
it's
right.
Also links from our sciencebrothers.org webpage. I do want to do a shout out for, I said it a few times, the Sea Perch program, which is a pretty awesome national level defense education program where you can actually build an ROV for $147. Doesn't have a camera, but still a vehicle you can throw in the water and do really cool things with. And that's seaperch.org. It's seaperch.org. And that's probably the two ones I want to shout out for.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for you guys coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Right, pleasure having you being here.
All right. Well, Jeff, we'll see you next week, I guess.
That'll be great. I'm looking forward to it.
Until then, keep on thinking about STEM.
All right. Take care.